Is America going the way of the Roman Empire? A growing number of Christians think so, and I'm one of them.
Rod Dreher talking about his presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That's why I say that Christians today should take a new look at the way the early Benedictine monks, who emerged out of the ruins of Rome, responded to the collapse of their civilization. We can learn from them how to build stable lives of prayer, Bible study, and worship in strong communities. The Benedict option, as I call it, is not about running away from the world. It's about learning the practices of discipleship that enable us to stand firm for Christ against the world for the sake of the world.
You can meet and hear Rod Dreher making the case for the Benedict option at the Fall Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Registration is $120. Child care is free. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
The Bible gives President Trump the moral authority to use whatever force necessary, including assassination or even war, to take out an evildoer like Kim Jong-un.
The Democratic Party has been led astray by the abortion rights movement that thinks that this abortion messaging is a winning strategy. It simply isn't a winning strategy outside California and New York.
The Reformation is the crystallization in God's providence of the gospel and of the authority of God's word. And it is a reminder to us that it's exactly what we need today.
This is Flo from Idaho. Locked and loaded Lutheran ladies love listening to the straight shooters at Issues Etc.
If you haven't heard about them yet, you will. And even if you never hear about them, they will still affect your life in some way, hopefully not in too detrimental a way. They're called SOGI laws, sexual orientation and gender identity laws. They purport, and they're pushed as and sold to many a state legislature and elsewhere, as protections for people who, well, kind of the winners of the sexual revolution. You know what we're talking about here? Those who have succeeded in law and in the minds of so many to both redefine marriage, to define out of existence male and female, to protect those. That's what SOGI laws are supposed to do. What they turn out actually being, and they're often implemented explicitly to do, is to punish the evildoers, as one billionaire supporter of the sexual revolution said several weeks ago he was planning to do. The SOGI laws, in many cases, are completely incompatible with religious freedom and freedom of conscience. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in on this Wednesday afternoon, the 16th of August. We're going to be talking about religious liberty protection laws and SOGI laws, the sexual revolution with Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation. Then Pastor Tom Baker will join us to teach a Sunday school lesson, The Rich Young Ruler, Matthew chapter 19. Joining us to talk about religious liberty, Dr. Ryan Anderson. He's a regular guest, senior research fellow in American Principles and Public Policy for the Heritage Foundation, author of several books, including Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom, and a recent column for National Review titled The Continuing Threat to Religious Liberty. Dr. Anderson, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
In that column, you kind of take us back to 1993 during the Clinton administration, where the RFRA law was signed by President Bill Clinton. And leading up to that, in congressional testimony, the ACLU emerged as a major supporter for religious freedom laws. What has changed in our country since 1993?
Sure. I mean, there are a number of things that you can point to as to why the ACLU has largely flip-flopped on religious liberty. I think the two that are most important in that part of the history is a change in kind of sexual values in the United States, and then a change in how we view religion. And so the change in sexual values, it's just that the sexual revolution has proceeded from contraception and abortion to the redefinition of marriage, now to new ideas about gender identity. And where you see the ACLU frequently going wrong on religious liberty is where religious liberty would protect the people who lost the sexual revolution. The Little Sisters of the Poor not wanting to have to provide contraception. The Green family, the owners of Hobby Lobby, not wanting to have to provide coverage for abortion. the baker or the florist, the photographer, not wanting to have to help celebrate same-sex weddings. Now we're even seeing Catholic hospitals being sued for not wanting to do sex reassignment surgeries. So part of this is the sexual revolution. And what initially started as a movement that was simply claiming freedom, we want to be free to live and to love how we want to, it's now being used, it's being weaponized to punish people who don't want to support or endorse or facilitate these new sexual values. The other cultural change has been how we view religion. Throughout the past 20 or so years, we've seen a rise in the push for secularism, the viewpoint that religion doesn't belong in the public square, doesn't belong in the public square as a political matter or as an economic matter. Religion is simply something that you do at home, not on Wall Street, not on Main Street. We've also seen religious communities themselves splinter. And so we've seen the mainline Protestant church become the old line, and now it's largely on the sidelines. And that's a phrase that Richard John Newhouse used to use. We've seen the Catholic community splinter in the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council. And so you have John Paul II Catholics, and then you have Spirit of Vatican II Catholics. And so as a result, religious communities themselves have splintered specifically on these sexual issues. So you have forces, secularists who say religious voices and religious perspectives shouldn't be in the public square, and then religious voices themselves disagreeing on what it is that they believe and how much they believe it. And it results in this situation in which the free exercise of religion has been redefined as merely the freedom of worship. And you even heard this during the Obama administration, both Secretary of State John Kerry and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had referred to the freedom of worship, not the free exercise of religion.
So has it come down to kind of an irreconcilable difference, forcing the public to make a choice or forcing the public to act according to someone else's choice when it comes to religious freedom? Is it actually religious freedom restoration acts and their like versus sexual orientation and gender identity laws, the SOGI laws?
Sure. So, I mean, that's part of it, and that actually highlights a third historical change, which is simply how much larger the claims of government now are. So if James Madison or Thomas Jefferson were to come back to the United States today and someone was to tell them about the Little Sisters of the Poor, their first response wouldn't be, well, the First Amendment protects the free exercise of religion. Their first response would be, what is the Department of Health and Human Services, and what gives it the authority to tell an order of nuns that they have to provide coverage for contraception in their health care plan? It's the growth of government, an unaccountable, ever-expanding kind of administrative state progressive form of governance. This isn't limited constitutional self-government that Madison and Jefferson thought they were setting up. And so as a result, in many of these cases, it's what's known as SOGI laws. SOGI is an acronym, S-O-G-I. It stands for Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. These laws elevate sexual orientation and gender identity to a protected class, gives them the same types of protections that we provide to race, to prevent discrimination on the basis of race. But what they do in effect is they say that if you believe we're created male and female, and that male and female are created for each other, you're functionally discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, and then the law is going to treat you in the same way that the law treats people who discriminate on the basis of race. That's where these lawsuits against Catholic adoption agencies and Catholic hospitals and evangelical bakers and florists and photographers, that's where they're coming from.
Let's talk about the bakers. I guess, although I do not in any way sympathize, I think I can barely understand why a government agency like the HHS would think that it has some compelling interest in what Little Sisters of the Poor does. What's even to this day, Ryan, impossible for me to wrap my head around is what the government's interest in making a baker bake a cake is.
So the argument here isn't that it's about the cake. They readily acknowledge that in many of these, if not all of these cases, there was another baker or florist or photographer very close by who was more than happy to do it. What they argue is that there's a dignity interest. They argue that in having a baker turn down the request for the same-sex wedding cake, it teaches that gay people are less than fully human. It dehumanizes them. It devalues them. And as a result, it inflicts what they're now calling dignitary harm. It's not a physical harm. It's not a material harm. It's not the type of harm that J.S. Mill was talking about when he defended the harm principle, that we have freedom unless it causes harm to other people. Because it's not causing that type of harm. It's causing a different type of harm. It's causing dignitary harm. And as a result, they say that it needs to be prohibited. Here, I just think that they get the entire analysis wrong from the get-go. The baker is not saying that gays and lesbians are second-class citizens, that they count for less, that we're treating them in a subhuman way. He's saying we disagree about the nature of marriage. And there are many things in our culture that we have to agree to disagree about. And the viewpoint that marriage is a conjugal union of a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, a mom and a dad, isn't based on any unjust or unfair beliefs about people who identify as gay and lesbian. And so you're simply smuggling in your conclusion when you say support for the historic understanding of marriage is, by its very definition, discrimination and anti-gay, and therefore contributes to dignitary harm. But they would actually need to have an argument for that. They would need to have evidence for that. And as far as we can tell from the cases that have come up, there isn't any evidence. Baronelle Stutzman, a 72-year-old grandmother in Washington State, she's employed gay people in her floral studio. She was selling flowers to the particular gay couple that sued her for a decade prior to that lawsuit. It was only when they asked for same-sex wedding flowers that she had to turn them down. This is radically different than what we saw with the Jim Crow South or with other racist businesses that simply refused to serve black people. That's not the type of discrimination or the creating of a caste system that we've seen anti-discrimination laws rightly go after in the past.
Dr. Ryan Anderson is our guest. We're talking about religious liberty, senior research fellow in American Principles and Public Policy for the Heritage Foundation, author of the book Truth Overruled and a recent column for National Review titled The Continuing Threat to Religious Liberty.
Christians should operate fully in the public square, and that includes by engaging with the media.
Molly Hemingway talking about her joint presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And one of the things that they can do is encourage reporters to report things accurately and truthfully. They can express their opinions in letters to the editor and op-eds. And one of the things that's important is to just let people in the world know of the differences of opinion that are out there, that Christians don't share a lot of the secular thinking that is promulgated by the media. And so being bold and being able to stand up and simply speak truth in the public square, it's a powerful witness to others, and it's a service you can perform for your community and the country at large.
You can meet and hear Molly and Mark Hemingway making the case for Christians engaging the news media at our Fall Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about religious liberty, the sexual revolution, SOGI laws, and RFRA laws. Dr. Ryan Anderson is our guest. Molly Hemingway of Fox News and Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard will be making the case for religious liberty at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Registration is $120. That includes meals Friday night and Saturday afternoon and Saturday evening. Child care is free, courtesy of the Consortium for Classical Lutheran Education, and attendance is limited to 400. So don't wait to register. Learn more at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2017 Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Dr. Anderson, you were talking before the break about the pushing of these SOGI laws and this notion of dignitary harm being pushed in the case of bakers refusing to bake wedding cakes for same-sex couples. Is anyone pushing this idea of dignitary harm, proposing some kind of limiting principle? For instance, I'm a baker. I say to a couple, I can't bake your cake. They say, you have to anyway. What is to stop someone from claiming an injury to their dignity, even if I bake the cake, but they know I don't really want to? I don't believe in what they're promoting.
Yeah, so there are a variety of attempts at limiting principles. And one would be, look, the law can't regulate thoughts. It can only regulate actions. And so there's no way for the law to regulate, you know, your willingness to do it or, you know, what you're thinking about when you're doing it. Another is that most people are not willing to penalize speech in this way. So the limiting principle is that free speech concerns. You can't force people to say something that they don't believe, which is interesting that they're willing to violate religious liberty because of dignitary harms. They're not willing to violate free speech protections because of dignitary harm, which I think just illustrates that it's partly because religion has been devalued over the past generation or two, that religious liberty is now being devalued. Speech rights are starting to be devalued, and we see some of that on college campuses with various protests and trigger warnings and safe spaces and things like that. But because everyone speaks, liberal and conservative, secular and religious, people tend to defend free speech protections more vigorously than they defend free exercise or religion protections. Let me give you one other example on how to think about this. You could see someone saying that because you won't perform an abortion, you're discriminating on the basis of sex. Only women can be pregnant, and by refusing to do an abortion, you're keeping women in a second-class citizen position, that they need an abortion in order to compete economically and in order to have careers and to flourish, and so you're subjugating them. And you're inflicting dignitary harm on them because you're judging their choice to have an abortion, and you're saying it's immoral, and you're saying that they're behaving in a subhuman way. The outcome of that line of argument is that pro-lifers should be forced to perform and pay for abortions, which thankfully our government has never agreed to do. So we should learn from the pro-life context, which was that sexism is wrong, but pro-life medicine isn't sexism. In the same way, we can say anti-gay bigotry is wrong, but support for marriage, the union of a man and a woman, isn't anti-gay bigotry. Those are the distinctions we need to be able to draw as a society if we're going to be able to kind of peacefully coexist in the future.
Is this something everyone, if they stop to think about it, should be deeply concerned about, even if they're irreligious or a-religious? Is this a broader question of what the government can do in anyone's life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the type of thing that all Americans should be concerned about, whether you are religious or non-religious, whether you agree with the particular religious beliefs that are at stake in some of these cases or not. Because what matters here is, are we going to have the type of government that can violate people's deepest convictions, their conscience, their religious beliefs and actions, simply because other citizens disagree with them? Is one group of citizens going to be able to use the power of the government to force another group of citizens to change their actions that flow from their conscientious beliefs without justification? Look, sometimes that has to happen. If your conscientious beliefs are that you should be murdering people, yeah, government should stop you. But if you're not causing those types of harms, the type of harm you're causing is a dignitary harm, is that sufficient, apart from other considerations, for the government to come in and to punish you?
You say that to, and this is what you write, to meet attacks on religious liberty, conservatives must avoid two pitfalls. Let's deal with them both one at a time. Opting out of politics and defending only our people. Let's start with opting out of politics. Why does it need to be avoided?
Sure, because right now, if you think of who has been on the forefront of defending religious liberty, you can look at great law firms like Alliance Defending Freedom and Beckett, two wonderful public interest law firms that litigate these cases. Then you have scholars. You have people like Robbie George, Jerry Bradley, academics, people at think tanks like Heritage and the Family Research Council, who are doing the public policy, who are doing the intellectual defenses of religious liberty. And then you have religious leaders, pastors like Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Convention and Archbishop Chaput, the Archbishop of Philadelphia, who are doing kind of the preaching and the sermons and the religious defense of religious liberty. And notice what's missing. You have the legal defense, you have the intellectual defense, you have the religious defense, you don't have the political defense. You don't have a group like the NRA that works to get people who defend the Second Amendment elected into office. You don't have a group like the Club for Growth, which works to get people in office who enact economic policies that will be good for economic growth. There's nothing like the Susan B. Anthony List, an organization that works to get pro-life women elected to Congress. We need some groups that form specifically to challenge politicians who are against religious liberty and to help elect politicians who will defend religious liberty. We have the other parts of the coalition, the legal, the intellectual, the theological. We don't yet have that political part. And we as citizens can't opt out of politics. We need to be active in ensuring that our elected representatives are protecting our rights, specifically our free exercise rights.
And why do conservatives need to avoid the pitfall of defending only, quote unquote, our people?
Because it's so tempting to say that the reason we care about religious liberty is to advance our religious message, that the reason we care about religious liberty is so that the gospel can advance. The reason we need to care about religious liberty is that all human beings have the right to seek out the truth about God and to respond to God as they understand God. We need to create the space for the gospel to flourish. That's accurate. But we also need to create the space for people to explore other alternatives precisely so that the truth can win out. The argument here is that this isn't a relativist claim that all religions are the same. It's that if the government is picking winners and losers in religion, it makes it less likely that people will come to embrace the truth. It works better where the separation of church and state is meant to protect the church from the state. Proper understanding here is that people have the right to respond to God. It's a right to be wrong, but it's not a right to do wrong. And so we need to allow people that space, even when we disagree with them. So you don't have to agree with the religious beliefs of your neighbor who you're defending, because that same principle is going to be the principle that defends your religious freedom. If we only defend religious freedom for the people we agree with, it's going to mean that the majority is the only group that gets their religious liberty rights protected. We want all people, whether they're the majority or the minority, or minorities, plural, to have their religious freedom protected.
You write this, Dr. Anderson, people are free to try to convince Jack Phillips that he should bake the cake, but the government shouldn't be allowed to force him to do so. In a nutshell, what do you mean?
Sure, this is exactly what religious liberty is all about. In the same way that I can try to persuade someone that Jesus is Lord, but the government shouldn't be able to force someone to accept Jesus as Lord, so too people should be able to try to convince Jack that he should embrace the sexual revolution and liberal values about marriage, but the government shouldn't force him to do that. So it's very similar to what we were just saying about religious liberty. It's not just for people who share our theological convictions. The government shouldn't be imposing Christian orthodoxy on people, but nor should it be imposing sexual revolution orthodoxy on people. And that's what's at stake in Jack's case, is that the government's trying to force him to embrace an understanding of marriage that he doesn't believe in.
Granted, Christianity is still, in many ways, a majority religion in the U.S., but is Christianity being singled out here, especially vis-a-vis other religious viewpoints that would have, in many cases, similar objections of conscience on the very same issues?
Well, I don't know if it's being singled out. I mean, it strikes me as much more likely that there aren't nearly as many Orthodox Jews or Muslims or Mormons who share these beliefs, who are also in business, who are also in neighborhoods where there might be someone coming asking for a same-sex wedding cake. So I don't know if it's targeting as just as much as there are more evangelicals and Catholics who share these beliefs, and so it's not surprising that it would be evangelicals and Catholics who are running afoul of the law first. But what this does highlight is that this isn't just a Christian thing. Orthodox Jews, Roman Catholics, evangelicals, Latter-day Saints, Muslims, a whole host of people believe we're created male and female, and that male and female are created for each other. And so the question now is, will the government be telling all of those people that they're discriminating and that the government's going to have to force them to violate their beliefs? It just strikes me that a much better situation here would be that we agree to disagree about what marriage is, and we don't penalize people who hold on to the historic understanding of marriage.
Dr. Ryan Anderson is Senior Research Fellow in American Principles and Public Policy for the Heritage Foundation, author of several books, including Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom, and a recent column for National Review titled The Continuing Threat to Religious Liberty. You can read it at our website and purchase Truth Overruled at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Anderson, thank you for your time.
Sure thing. Thank you.
We'll be teaching a Sunday school lesson, The Rich Young Ruler in Matthew chapter 19, with Pastor Tom Baker of Law and Gospel after this.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
When a Christian woman is critical of her own flesh, she holds her Creator in contempt.
Rose Adel, from her new book, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Our Heavenly Father knit us together in the womb. He did not do a bad job. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Psalm 139:14. That goes for everyone, including the one who thinks she's the ugliest of them all.
You can purchase and download Concordia Publishing House's new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically, at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes.
¿Por qué hay cuatro evangelios? ¿Qué pasa con los bebés que mueren antes de nacer? ¿Qué significa temer a Dios? Respuestas bíblicas a preguntas difíciles se encuentran en la edición de agosto de The Lutheran Witness, una revista de la Iglesia Luterana, Sínodo de Missouri. Visite a cph.org/trylutheranwitness para una oferta especial. 6 ediciones para $6.99. The Lutheran Witness, interpretando a un mundo contemporáneo desde una perspectiva cristiana.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Redeemer Lutheran, Mandeville, Louisiana. Our Savior Lutheran, Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. Christ Lutheran, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Emmanuel Lutheran, Louisville, Nebraska. Grace Lutheran, Warminster, Pennsylvania. Trinity Lutheran, Valonia, Indiana. Emmanuel Lutheran, Pensacola, Florida, St. Athanasius Lutheran, Vienna, Virginia, and Emmaus Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.